Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Julie, thank you very much. This hour of the show is being brought to you by Horowitz and Horowitz, Illinois' top personal injury lawyers. Tony, let's go. Hour two of the program. What a wonderful conversation we had with Chris Herring. It's really, 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 really cool to have him talking about what he does and the way that he writes and the importance of using numbers, but the way you use numbers being important as well.
Right.
That's what Guest Week is all about, man. We bring in the good guests, and we had to bring this guy back. Because the conversation that we had about Brian Urlacher a couple weeks ago, I wanted to revisit that as we are on the eve of finding out whether Brian is going to get into the Hall of Fame. Jack Silverstein, and some people in his family pronounce it Silverstein. We still haven't gotten that story.
The opposite.
Wait, Jack Silverstein, but some people pronounce it Silverstein.
Yes.
In his family.
Yes.
And you said it was a long story.
It was a longish story enough that I wasn't going to go into it. But if invited, it comes down. It's very, very, very simple. It's very simple. There was, I've heard it kind of both ways. And what happened was that I grew up with two girls, one of whom, one of her parents' last name was Silverstein. And she actually used a hyphenated last name, and she went by Silverstein. And there was another girl, and her last name was Sternstein. And Frankenstein is a man. So I went the gender route, and I said, well, then I'm Silverstein. If she's Sternstein, and she's Silverstein, and he's Frankenstein, then I'm Silverstein.
Okay. But the other family members have stayed with...
I didn't alert them.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
This was just...
They're just finding out now?
They've known, but I didn't... Let's put it this way. I didn't ask for permission.
Okay.
And I was always somebody who was very intense about what my name would be and how it would be stylized. So originally I just wrote Jack, all capital letters. And then Miss Amos in first grade said, actually, you have to write your full name. So then I was like, okay, fine. And I wrote Jack Michael Silverstein. And she said, you don't have to go that far. So then I wrote, okay, fine, Jack M. Silverstein. And that's where the M came from. Then in about fourth grade, I started signing everything Jack M. Silverstein, number 87, after Tom Waddle.
Okay.
Then I went to back to all caps, but it was written in bubble letters and designed with a face in the middle of the J that had a White Sox hat and then, and this is another long story, later a Cubs hat. And actually, if you could find my SATs right now on the front of the booklet, you would see Jack written in all caps, bubble letters, with the hat and the face. So then that was that name. And I'm sorry. So I had a nickname at overnight camp. And actually, I went to the same camp that Dan Bernstein attended.
He told me what your nickname was.
Did he?
Well, I don't know if he's right, but Abu?
That is right.
He said, you're having Abu in? I was like, the dude from The Simpsons? He's like, no, Jack. I was like, Jack's name's Jack. And he said, no, he's a North Star camp kid. His nickname, everyone knows him as Abu.
Yeah.
What is that about?
My first summer at camp was 1993 when Aladdin was out. And what happens is that kids get nicknamed very, very fast for a lot of reasons, but just because I think nicknames are fun. And two counselors all of a sudden called me Abu because they thought I looked like the monkey from Aladdin. I have a widow's peak. And I don't know, it came up. I have big ears that kind of stick out, and I make a lot of faces. And I jump around and all this stuff. So they started calling me Abu. And it stuck.
Did
to
you
the point,
punch anyone in the face for doing
no,
that?
No, I was pleased. Listen, it was my first year at camp. I knew some people going in, but I'd never gone to sleepaway camp. It's a huge deal. I was going for 8 weeks. There's a lot on the line. So if these counselors who are like the kings of camp, the idols of idols, are going to bless me with some name that they all seem happy about, I enjoyed Aladdin. I mean, at the time. But
I probably would have hit someone in the face with a tray.
Yeah, well, no.
Obviously there's different social context to it, but yeah. Right, exactly.
So I went with that, and actually when my parents came up to visit, parent visiting weekend was in the fifth week. So there's kids who go for 8 weeks, and then there's kids who go for the first 4 weeks, and there's kids who go for the second 4 weeks. The parent visiting weekend was in the fifth week. So most of those kids, by that point, only knew me as Abu. And my parents, we were supposed to meet somewhere, and there was a miscommunication. My parents walking around, and they said to some kid, "Do you know Jack Silverstein?" "No." "Do you know?" "No." They're looking for me. And then finally, like, my mom nudged my dad because I said it in letters. She said, try Abu. She said, "Do you know Abu?" "Oh, Abu. He went right over there." So that's very funny that Dan knows me as that. That is, I mean, that is exclusively as I'm known at camp.
That is strange.
There are people who
the world is very small.
Yeah.
It's a very small world. You find that out quite a bit. Jack, I didn't give him the propers, writes for Windy City Gridiron. He is a sports historian, and he is one of my favorite guests that we have in here, which is why he's in here so frequently. I know that people are sitting there on pins and needles about Urlacher, and you made a very good case a couple weeks ago about Brian getting into the Hall of Fame on this ballot. If you could just, I'd love it if you could just go back down the way that this happens, like how we get down to the possible five that end up in the Hall of Fame.
Sure. And what I did when I wrote this is I did two things. One, I went on to the Pro Football Hall of Fame website and read everything about the selection process and then distilled it down to like the basic steps. And then I read this great Sports Illustrated story from 2014 by, I think, Robert Klemko. And he interviewed some people who were involved in the voting. So I put that together. But I do encourage anyone who's interested to check out Brad Biggs's interview with Dan Pompey that ran. I saw it online this morning. I don't know if it's in today's paper or yesterday's. But Dan from The Athletic, from Bleach Report, formerly of Tribune, obviously just longtime NFL reporter, he will be presenting Brian's case. The way that this works quick is there are 48 voters, and one voter from the person's city presents the case to everyone. And there's going to be 15 modern era nominees, and they're going to run all the way through. Well, Biggs did a wonderful interview with Dan that talked about exactly how this works in greater detail than I had put together. If you've read my story, then you have the gist of it, but I do encourage everyone to check that out. What he said is that one of the important things that goes on as we look ahead to whether or not Brian's going to get in, one of the important things that goes on is the order of which they are presented. You have 15 people. They're there at 6:30 in the morning, and they're there all day. And Dan said that if you have one of the first slots, that, you know, people might forget about that person by the end. You know, like why they don't want to release movies that have Oscar shots in February. Because
right.
By the time you're voting, who, what movie? So that's one thing. If you're at the end, people might be exhausted. Brian is going to be presented in the middle. And what Dan has done is he's done all of his own independent research. He has interviewed a ton of people, obviously teammates, but I think what's going to carry more weight is the interviews with opponents, Brett and Adrian Peterson and opposing coaches, Tony Dungy and all these people. And he's put together a packet that he emailed to all the voters, and he is going to then bring hard copies on Saturday, and he's going to lay out the case. There are 15 finalists. There is going to be a vote to get that number down to 10. There's going to be another vote to get that number down to 5. And then there is going to be an up-down yes-no vote.
Where you need 80%.
Fives. You need 80%. It's 38 votes. 38, 80% of the 48 voters is 38. And that's how it's going to go. So Dan has a really great case. Obviously, he knows Brian. He does not have the problem that some people have of a guy who's already been there. So he wrote about, you know, he presented Richard Dent 4 years in a row. Well, if you present a guy the first time and he doesn't get in, all right, maybe that's a numbers game. You present him the second time or the third time and he's not getting in, well, now you have to change up your message. You have to do something because what you're saying is not resonating. Maybe it's still a numbers game, but, you know, he cited Art Monk and the length of, you know, the number of years that Monk had to wait, or Chris Carter or Terrell Davis, or the weird one, Everson Walls, who is in his 20th year right now of Hall of Fame eligibility and has never made it to the semifinal round. And all of a sudden, he's a finalist. And I wonder, because of that, I picked him as my dark horse candidate to get into the Hall of Fame, just because it's odd to me that, you know, I looked at like the background of how everybody gets in and how long they have to wait. No one's waited 20 years and then all of a sudden they're a finalist. Like Joe Jacoby has waited a really long time, but he's gotten into that semifinal round or that final round. So they're going to vote it all the way down and then they're going to vote yes or no. And from reading Pompeii, the essence of the case is going to be a couple things. One, just overall talent and the versatility of skills. The fact that in Dick Geron's defense, he was playing closer to the line and collecting a bunch of sacks. And then in Lovey's defense, he's playing pass coverage and knocking more passes down and intercepting more passes. And there's a clear line in his stats where you're like, if you didn't know, you'd be like, oh, what happened here? Why do his stats look totally different? And we know, and that's why. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he can do those two things. Don Pearson added a really interesting nugget. When Brian won Defensive Player of the Year, which obviously is a big award, but historically is a huge award because it's the MVP of the defense. The Offensive Player of the Year award is a little bit screwy because people do things like, oh, this quarterback is the MVP of the league, but he's not the Offensive Player of the Year. They want to split it or whatever happens. But there's no question marks about the Defensive Player of the Year. That's your defensive MVP. The year that Brian won Defensive Player of the Year, he had, guess how many interceptions?
Two.
Zero. Guess how many recovered fumbles?
One.
Zero.
Really?
Brian Urlacher was so good, and maybe some of this has to do with narrative, because obviously we had that huge surprise season at 11-5, but Brian Urlacher was so good that he won Defensive Player of the Year with no interceptions and no recovered fumbles. Herb and I and Herb, Tony and I were just talking about Brian versus Ray. This is another piece that's going to come up for Dan Pompeii. And what he has said is he's going to make Brian's case without having to disparage Ray Lewis, because he says they both belong in. And it's, he's not trying to say like Brian is better necessarily. He just wants to say, look, there have never been two middle linebackers who have been up for this at the same time, like these two guys. I think a really interesting thing, and we talked a little bit about this, but again, all of these testimonials from opponents. And did you see the story with Kevin Mawai?
No, I did not.
Kevin Mawai was interviewed, and I'm sure our listeners know this name. Your listeners, excuse me, know this name.
It's our listeners.
It's our listeners right now.
It's guest week. You're a guest on the show. You're our listeners too.
I feel it. But Kevin Mawai was an All Pro multiple years, All Pro center for the Seahawks and the Jets and the Titans, and he's one of the finalists. And there is a very good chance that he will get in as well. And if he doesn't get in this year, then next year. I mean, he is really, really great. And Kevin Mawai was giving an interview, and he said that Brian was tougher to play against than Ray. And this is interesting for two, maybe three reasons. One, the obvious one, that Kevin Mawai is a great authority. He never was teammates with either of these guys. He's one of the very, very best at all time at his position. And he's in the middle, obviously, of the field. So he's seeing Brian and Ray in the middle of the field. And he's a finalist for the Hall of Fame, so his opinion carries a lot of weight. But the specifics of what he said was that Ray would try to dodge a block and Brian would take on a block. And that goes right in the face of this idea that, well, Brian's problem is that he can't shed blocks. Not only could he shed them, but he went after them. And that also flies in the face of this idea that, like, well, Brian was just, he was just an athlete. He was just running around all fast, but Ray is a real football guy. Again, I'm not trying to disparage Ray Lewis. I'm just looking at the ways in which people formulate these stories around people, around players. So it was very, very interesting to hear Kevin Mawai say, I think that Brian was the harder player because he could do more and he was more physical. He said that he would worry more about Zach Thomas than Ray Lewis. So when you start to Google, other than whatever Dan Pompey presents all these voters, if they, between now and Saturday morning, start Googling Brian Urlacher Hall of Fame, the returns are going to be all positive. They're going to get my story, hope they read it, but they're going to get so many testimonials from other writers, from players, from coaches, and they're going to get arguments that refute maybe what they think they think. Such as Brian Urlacher can't shed blocks. Well, no, a Hall of Fame finalist center, 6- or 7-time All-Pro first-team center, who Olin Krutz has given dap on Twitter because he's like, he is that dude. He's saying Brian is tougher to play than Ray. I think Brian's going in the Hall of Fame. I mean, I know I've said that and I wrote it, and I think his case, you know, he did the interview obviously with Lance and he said, one of the things that keeps him calm is that his statistics aren't going to change between when they did the interview and when he gets
there's nothing
gets voted.
He can do about it.
There's nothing he can do. They're not going to get any worse. They're not going to get any better. But I think his case actually got better because we've had more people writing, and something like Kevin Mawai, I think that's going to go a real, real, real long way.
That's a good guy to have in your corner, and you're right about the relationship between Krutz and Mawai. That's someone that he's respected for a very, very long time. And we're going to talk about that because you wrote a great piece on Olin that I want to get into. This segment was brought to you by Indeed.com. Are you hiring? With Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates in online dashboards. Get started at Indeed.com/hire. If you need legal advice by a reputable attorney, send questions you want answered to cbschicago.com/legal advice or look online for free Legal Fridays with Horowitz, Horowitz and Associates. That's cbschicago.com/legal advice. Is there a case for Olin Krutz to go into the Hall of Fame? I'll talk with Jack Silverstein about that next here on The Score. Julie, thank you very much. Julie DeCaro's got the scoreboard update. She's going to be on the air after I'm done. Ordinarily on Friday, we go till 9. Julie was nice enough to let us go until 10 tonight because it's guest week. Jack Silverstein is in here right now. Anna Bellaval is on her way. She's going to join me from 8 until 9. And then there's a problem. 9 o'clock, Tony Gill, Shane Reardon, two of the guys that produced the show. We're going to give them their airtime, and I'm apologizing right now for that.
Let's go!
That's right, Tony. That's what we're going to do at 9 o'clock. Jack Silverstein is in here. He writes for Windy City Gridiron. He is a fantastic sports historian, and I'm fascinated by the work that he does. Great stuff on Urlacher. If you miss the Urlacher stuff on Twitter, I was recording it while you were talking about it with video.
Oh.
So part of the argument for Urlacher is up on my Twitter account at Lawrence W. Holmes. You can follow Jack at Reed Jack. Why did you want to sit down and talk with and cover Olin Krutz?
Well, I've been doing a lot of interviews with guys from the Lovie Smith era, partially because my paths have just crossed with them enough that it was just.
Those teams. That's how I met you.
Right, exactly. So I've been doing a number of these long form interviews with these guys. The one that stood out to I think the most people at first was Cedric Benson, because I tracked him down and that was someone who people hadn't heard from in a while. I had a great conversation with Thomas Jones, but really with everybody. So this series has had Peanut, Pat Manley, who put me in touch with Olin, Jason McKee, Rashid Davis and I did an interview all about how he got open on third down. Mm. And that was basically the entirety of the interview. And it was really, really cool. And I hope I'm not forgetting anybody. But yeah, so I wanted to get in touch with Olin. And so I texted Manley and he put me in touch with him. And Olin and I had like a 30-minute conversation on the phone just to kind of get to know each other, because he wasn't on the team when I started covering the team when I was on the beat, because I came in 2011. And so we talked for a while, and just in the course of conversation, he mentioned, oh, well, this day doesn't work because I've got football. He coaches his son, his six kids, two sons, and his second son is in eighth grade, and he coaches his son's seventh and eighth grade football team. And I was like, oh my God, I want to go see that. Like that'd be great. So he said, sure. I came out.
What's it like for one of the most intimidating players in the NFL to teach children how to play football?
He is so calm and so quiet and so patient. And I got out onto the field in Winnetka on a Friday night in October, and I'm looking and I'm trying. I didn't know which team he was, which side of the field. So I'm just like, okay, I'm going to look for Olin Krutz, because I know what Olin Krutz looks like, right? First of all, he's lost, depending on the reading that you have, he's down to 260. He played between 280 and 290, he said.
I think he looks thinner than that to me.
Yeah. So I saw him listed at 300 at one point in his career. I saw him at 297. He says he was 280 to 290. In college, he was like 285. He says he's 260. And it shows. I mean, you're like, where's Olin Krutz? Oh, is that him? Additionally, I'm thinking a guy who had knee surgeries on both of his knees, played, what, like 200 games as a center in that squatting position. I'm figuring I'm looking for someone who's limping. He's not limping. He's in great shape. And I'm thinking, all right, well, I'm at least looking for someone who's going to be kind of yelling. He's going to be fiery, ferocious. Nope. Turns out the person I was looking for is a slim, non-limping, straight-walking, calm, quiet, quiet coach. And I wouldn't even say, I mean, he's a coach, but more of a teacher and a guide. So at halftime, he brings his team. It was cold. It was 35 degrees maybe, and it's night. And at halftime, they're up 13-0, and he brings his team over to a little area away from the field. Now, what you have to picture, this is eighth grade football. So there's a football field, it's tackle football, but there's like a soccer field next to it, and there's kids running around playing soccer. And there's parents sitting on cold benches, and there's another group of parents who have a little table set up, and they're pouring, you know, hot chocolate for people and water. You know what I'm saying? It's youth football.
Sure.
And it's not even totally quote-unquote Friday Night Lights, because it's not high school. It's eighth graders in Winnetka. And there's Olin Krutz coaching the eighth graders. And he brings them over and he says, and he starts talking to them, and he's just, you know, full on verbiage. You know, hey, what do you see with this linebacker? Where's the backside gap? What do you, you know, are they in a 5-2 or a 6-2? Where's the second backer? All this. And he says, somebody tell me something about 16 power. 16 power. What do you got on 16 power? And they're looking at it and they describe it. And he says, listen, this is it. 16 power is an attitude play. It's a run play. So 16 power is an attitude play. We know we're going to run 16 power. They know we're going to run 16 power. Our parents know we're going to run 16 power. Their parents know we're going to run 16 power. But can they stop it? And that was the big similarity between the way that he talked with the kids and the way that he talked about his team and his time with the Bears, because he told me, and this might not have gotten into the interview because I cut a lot of the 06 stuff, because we really then zeroed in the story about his position on the safety of the game, the future of it, concussions, all that. But he said that there was NFL Films footage from the 06 playoff game against Seattle where one of their coaches is on the sideline during that game saying, look, these guys only run three plays. You just got to stop them. So Olin, that lesson, I'm sure, you know, stayed with him. And he was great. He was great. The story that I kicked off my story with was he had some big kids. He had a kid who, after when we were doing our follow-up interview, I was like, hey, how big was three, the kid who made the hit? How big was three? I was like, because three looks like he was my size. And Olin was like, that's not saying much.
It is for an eighth grader.
Right, right, right. So Olin's team punted, and the opposing punt returner is looking up. He fields the punt, and this big kid is coming straight downhill, and bam, hits him. Clean hit, good hit, knocks him out. This kid is laid out. Seventh or eighth grade boy, I didn't find out. Laid out on the ground. And it happened right near his sideline. So his coach is going off. All of the parents are going off. They're yelling at Olin's player. And Olin very calmly walks over there and says to the coach, like, hey, you know what? Chill out. Like, no one wants to see this kid laying on the ground, but just don't yell at my kid. You know what I'm saying? And he walks him back over and he says, listen, guys, sometimes parents get a little too crazy. He says, this has nothing to do with you. It was a good hit. I want you to play clean football. I want you to hit hard, but hit clean. I started interviewing some of the parents on the sidelines, and by chance, and you know, no one's wearing name tags, by chance I interviewed the father of the boy who put on the hit. And in the interview I said, you know, give me a story that, you know, obviously as a parent, you trust these adults with your children, and you never know, obviously, who's who. Give me a story that tells you, oh, yeah, Olin's a guy who I want in charge of my kid. And he said, well, I think we just saw it. We just saw what happens when Olin's in charge of my kid, because he has this in perspective, and he's not going to let some adult yell at my kid. And that went such a far way for this parent. And those were all the stories. I kept saying, describe Coach Kreutz. What's he like as a coach? The first word out of everybody's mouth, calm. So I watched that and I was like, okay, yeah, this is what I have to write about. This is it right here. And Olin, I then went to, he owns a gym in Lake Forest, and we sat for a little over an hour and talked about everything. I mean, the story ended up being very, very tight because it was a great topic. And for anyone who hasn't seen it at Windy City Gridiron, the story is that Olin Kreutz has become a great advocate for football. He is coaching at the youth level. He's done this for 6 years. And he's here on The Score. And he's on Twitter interacting with fans. And he's defending
and breaking down tape like nobody's business.
And he's doing his own tape. So he films all that and he puts it up. And, you know, he was just talking about he wants the NFL to say what youth should be doing. He wants the NFL to get in there and say either all of these things that you're reading about, all of these tests. You know, he brought up the New York Times study that they looked at
110 of the 111 brains that they saw
had CTE.
Had CTE.
And something that I had thought about was a point that he made. He said, yeah, when you do a test on 111 people who think maybe they had dementia, yeah, 110 of them did. So one of the reasons that I keep interviewing football players and that I'm really interested in it is that obviously there are so many terrible stories. And there are really great pieces of journalism that we've seen about guys who are really torn up and say, oh, I wouldn't play football again. Antoine Randall L., who I went to college with, has talked about that. And yet every time I interview somebody from that team and I say, well, would you play again? They say, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the only person who said he wouldn't was Thomas Jones. And even Thomas was like, but I don't want you to get the wrong idea. I love football. And I loved my time playing football. And I was a little worried because Thomas and I have, you know, like I'll text him every now and again and we'll talk on Twitter. He retweets my stuff that has nothing to do with him and we're in touch. And I like him a lot. And I was a little bit nervous that I'm running this story with Kreutz, who's saying things like, I'm not going to give back my big house, so I can't give back my injuries. And he was like, you know, I don't understand anybody who says, well, I want to play football, but I don't want to get hurt. Well, you better find another profession and all this. And
I thought the point that he made in your piece, and you can read it on Windy City Gridiron, that we need to probably get to a point where guys need to sign waivers. I think that's a really fair point. That for a long time, for me, it felt like the NFL didn't do the best job of explaining what the dangers could be for these players. And I think that's where they failed them. I think there's more information out there now. I wish there was even more. But I understand where he's coming from, and he does seem to understand. And what I saw from the piece that Olin says, look, if you're going to get hurt, then let's take some of this out of it by making people sign a waiver. And I completely understand Thomas's point of, and this was one of the tough guys. Like Thomas Jones was a tough guy.
All-time tough guy.
You know, I remember seeing him get a knee injury and them saying he was going to be out for 4 weeks. And he slept at the facility and did all of the ice and stem
before the Ravens game.
And boom, he was there the next week. I got to take a break.
Yeah.
I want to conclude with on Olin, but I also want to ask you before we get you out of here about IU and Bobby Knight, because that's going to be a 30 for 30, and you were there when it happened.
I was
with Jack Silverstein after a quick timeout. This segment being brought to you by CC's at CC's. If you don't see what you want in the buffet, you can order your own personal pizza. There's thousands of ways to customize it your way, and it's included with your buffet for just 3, 2, 1. 5 and change, only at CC's. Dine-in only, price may vary, restrictions apply. Back after this on The Score. When I'm done talking with Jack, Anna Belleval of Channel 9 will be here on the show.
Yeah.
And what she doesn't know is that we're going to give her a sports quiz. That's not true. Anna's like, she's terrified that we're going to talk sports. I'm like, we're probably not going to talk any sports at all. And she's like, oh, okay. We're going to have a good time.
She has one of the coolest jobs in the city.
Yes. Her around town segment is fantastic.
So much fun.
I mean, I'm sure there'll be some serious stuff because I do want to talk to her about Puerto Rico
and everything that's happened
in Puerto Rico since she is of Puerto Rico. So I want to talk to her about that. But she's like, do I have to know sports? Do I like, no, not at all. We don't know sports. Before I let you go, Jack Silverstein is here in studio with me at Reed Jack is where you can find him on Twitter. Check out his story on Olin Kreutz on WindyCityGridiron.com. It's really good. His argument for Brian Urlacher as a first ballot Hall of Famer on Windy City Gridiron is also top notch. I saw last night, I didn't see the two bills, but I did see at the end of the two bills, the 30 for 30, that it looks like there's going to be a 30 for 30 on the last days of Bobby Knight at Indiana.
Yeah.
You were at Indiana when they fired Bobby Knight.
Yes.
Julie, were you there too when they fired him? Ooh, boy. So, wow, Julie, the faces she's making right now are hysterical. So, Jack, were you writing for the paper by then, or were you just on campus?
I was writing for the paper, but I was doing movie reviews. I mean, I wasn't out there for anything other than just because, wow, what in the heck is happening?
Okay. Yeah. So what did you think of it? Like, was that back then, was that a draw for you to go to IU that Hoosiers basketball was still being coached?
Not in the least.
Okay.
No. I wanted to go to a game to see Bob Knight because I'm a sports fan and I wanted to see a legend in action. But I chose to go to Indiana because of the journalism program, because I'd be able to write for the newspaper my freshman year, because I liked the campus, because I liked the proximity to home. Both how far away it was and how close it was, but it had nothing to do. I grew up a Northwestern fan because I grew up in Evanston, and we could hear the PA system on the rare days when we didn't go to the football game. We could hear the PA system from the field across the street from our house where we all played football.
I don't know if I've ever met anyone who said I grew up a Northwestern fan.
Oh my God. But I mean, that's a whole nother story. I had, one of my big gets for an interview sophomore year of high school when I had a radio show was I got Pat Fitzgerald to come to my house and spend 2 hours in my basement right after his senior year and break down the last like two seasons. And I've got a tape actually of him talking about wanting to be a coach one day.
Wow. And that's great.
And so we did that. And so I was a Northwestern fan. And I wanted to go to Indiana University. And the two things were totally separate. And as a result of that, I didn't really think about the fact that, like, this school that I've chosen to attend for these reasons is also this place where there's this national sports story going on for these reasons. So the day that Bob Knight was fired, remember he had the zero tolerance policy put on him the previous spring because of the Neil Reed video where they found out that he had choked a player. So they'd put the zero tolerance policy on him, which was everyone was like, well, what does that mean? And how is he going to survive a zero tolerance policy? And that seems like just if you're going to fire the guy, just fire him. I mean, that was like the attitude around it. And he was walking in the basketball stadium. There was a couple of kids, a couple of freshmen, and one of them said, "Hey, Knight," as the story goes. And he grabbed him by the shirt and said, "I'm not Knight. I'm Coach Knight, or I'm Mr. Knight." Now, how rough was that interaction? That's hearsay, obviously, but they both sides say that's what happened. And with maybe that was, I don't think that was the Sunday. That might have been like Friday. But by Sunday, word was out that he was fired. We watched a Bears game at noon. And when the game ended, I flipped to ESPN and I see a reporter in front of the basketball stadium. Bob Knight has been fired and we're, you know, going to be here and look at this crowd forming behind us. And it was at that moment where I was like, oh, that's right. This is here. Because I looked out my window and I was like, there's the basketball stadium. There's that reporter. So my friend and I, who grew up together, went to school together, we went out, we joined this crowd because I just wanted to see what was happening. And there's this guy with a bullhorn who's going, We didn't come here to watch some assistant coach, and George Leach didn't come here to play for some assistant coach. George Leach was a sophomore, and he was standing there in the crowd, like looking like, "What? Why is this?
Why you gotta bring my name up?
Why you gotta bring my name up?" Right. And we're not gonna take this, and we're, you know, tear up your tickets. We're not gonna watch these games, and we're not gonna support this. The new coach hadn't been named yet. It was gonna be between Mike Davis, who got the job, and I don't remember the other assistant, but we're not going to watch this team. And Miles Brand has got to go. If you remember that, if you've heard the name Miles Brand, he was the president of IU at the time. He went on to be the head of NCAA, and then he passed away, I don't know, in the last decade. We're going to the president's house. We're doing this now. We're going to be heard. So we walk or march, and I'm just like, this is my second week at school. And I'm like, what is going on right now? And we march all the way to the president's house. And now, like, the sun is starting to go down. Many more people have joined in this group. And the president's house, there's like this, I mean, at the time, I don't know if it still is, but there's this big, like, half circle lawn. And then there's this big half circle driveway. And then there's more grass. We're all right up against the driveway. And people are slowly creeping up and up and up to get, you know, because like the people in the back are trying to get to the front. The people in the front are getting angry and everybody's kind of moving up. Now I'm in the front and I'm like 5'7", 130 and slow, whatever like a slow 40 time is, like 6'8 or 8'3 or okay, whatever a slow 40 time is, that's what I run. And I only bring that up because I'm like prime target for trampling. And I'm looking around. Yep, I'm looking around and I'm seeing they're hanging effigies and burning effigies of this kid, this freshman in college. And then I look to the front and there's riot cops and gas masks. And I'm like, oh man, I got to creep to the back of this group. And I do. And as soon as I got back there, pop, 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 zish, you know, all these gas canisters are going off and people are running around and screaming. I mean, it was insanity. And I just remember being like, wow, this is college. Like, This is a trip.
That is something. Man, Jack, it's always a pleasure. The time always goes too fast when you're here. Great stuff as always.
Yes.
Great case for Brian Urlacher on Windy City Gridiron. Great. I really implore you to read the piece about Olin Krutz on Windy City Gridiron. It's a different viewpoint than most people see Olin through. And Jack just does incredible work. He is a fantastic sports historian in Chicago. Follow him on Twitter, @ReJack. Thanks,
right,
my man.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And I'll have a sick MJ and Kobe 1998 NBA All-Star Game look back on Monday on barberschairdigital.com. Check it out.
Thank you, sir. When we come back, Anna Belleval from Channel 9 is going to join me, and we're going to give her a sports quiz. We're not. We're just going to hang out with her. That's next on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.